Okay, good afternoon. Curious cultures, I wasn't quite sure what to talk about, and so I may not pronounce everything correctly, and I didn't know really anything about this until yesterday, what I was going to talk about. So hopefully the facts on the internet are correct. I guess we'll see. So what I'm going to talk about is the, I think they're called Kazakhs. Kazakhs, something like that. During the medieval Central Asia, this term was a term for people that had taken or achieved independence from some authority, and it is said that fine horses and fierce eagles are the wings of the Kazakh. So they came from the Turkic and Mongolic and Indo-Iranian indigenous groups and Huns who live between Siberia and the Black Sea. Today, the majority of the Kazakhs I am talking about actually live in Western Mongolia, in a province meaning the rich cradle, and I'm not going to try to pronounce the province, the actual name. The border of this province is separated from Kazakhstan by a 25-mile strip of Russian and Chinese mountains. They also live in parts of Russia, Kazakhstan, and China. Kazakhs are the largest ethnic minority group in Mongolia, which is only 4% of the population there. But the province that they live in make up 88% of the population in that one province. More and more of the Kazakhs are becoming more developed people, but they still practice a lot of their old traditions from the past and keep their culture alive. So there are a lot of the Kazakhs that are living a normal life, but there's still a small group that still keep the past traditions. And so they're a semi-nomadic people. They still roam the mountains and the valleys with their herds. Many of the families will move up to four times a year throughout the year to go find new pastures so that their herds have enough to eat and drink. They have a different pasture they travel to for each season, and then they'll come back to that pasture year after year and use that, and then they pass that pasture on that they use from generation to generation. They raise fat-tailed sheep, camels, and horses. Mutton and horse are their preferred meats to eat, and they also like sour milk because it's easier to store and go along with their way of life. I guess if you have sour milk, you don't have to worry about your milk getting sour, right? So one thing about when they eat, or when they have a respected guest come see them, one thing they do, so this is, I found this, this is just something that I pulled out of a section of story. In rural settings, it is a sign of respect to offer the most honored guest a boiled sheep's head on a beautiful plate. The guest then divides the food among the guests in the following fashion. The ear is given to the smallest child so that he or she will listen to and obey the elders. The eyes are given to the two closest friends so that they will take care of the guest. The upper palate is given to the daughter-in-law and the tongue of the host's daughter so both women will hold their tongues. The pelvic bones go to the second most respected guest and the brisket is given to the son-in-law. Another thing they do when they eat, when they're done eating, they leave food on their plate to show that they're finished. And so if you eat all your food, that shows that you're still hungry. Their main mode of transportation still is the horse. And they use the Mongol horse, which is a native-born horse breed of Mongolia. The horses are very small, and people often mistake them for little ponies. Traditionally, it is said that a Kazakh without a horse is like a bird without wings. Whenever they move, they take down and set back up their yurt, which is a felt house, which is like a round, transportable dwelling, kind of like the Native American teepee, except that it's shorter and flatter. And they have them furnished with embroidered felt and woven textiles. The Kazakhs wear a lot of embroidered clothing. The women wear bright headscarves and the men wear skull caps or fox fur hats. So they're the way they live, strongly influenced by traditional, or their work, what they do, by traditional gender roles. The men take care of the herd, they hunt, while the women cook, take care of the children, and prepare textiles. They have a patriarchal society. They band together into extended family groups to protect themselves from the environment and to protect their herds and their family. The father plays a primary role in family life, and it's his job to make sure the family survives. So I think one of the neatest things about the Kazakhs is the way they hunt. And they hunt for fur. They hunt foxes and animals like that, rabbits, for the fur, for their clothing. And so it's a very old tradition that they do for the hunting. They use eagles to catch and kill their the animals. So right now they're probably, it's said, around 250 people that actually know how to hunt with these eagles in Mongolia. So it's a very small group of people. To begin the season of hunting in mid-October, they have a golden eagle festival to signal the opening of the hunting season. It's a colorful event attracting a bunch of hunters and a lot of the hunters and their birds. And so where they live, it's a very big, vast, empty area with lots of mountains. And so they use the eagles to find their prey. Because it's a lot easier for them to do that than to go out and find the fox or whatever they're hunting themselves. So the hunter usually wears boots, black coats, and fur hats while they ride their horse. And then their eagle just sits on their arm. And they put a covering over the eagle's head so the eagle can't see where they're going. So the eagle can't see until it's time to start hunting. So when the hunter needs to get an eagle or to hunt with, he goes and finds a nest, eagles that are just born. He goes and finds a nest. He up in the mountain somewhere, he takes the eagle home and then he trains it for 6 months. And a lot of that training is becoming attached to the eagle, forming a relationship with the eagle, so that when they're out hunting, he can't necessarily keep the eagle with him, right? Because when he lets it fly to go find the prey, the eagle could just leave, and so he needs to form a relationship with the eagle so the eagle will come back after it's killed the prey. So for about around 6 months that they train the eagles. And so then they take him out to hunt. During the hunt, the man rides on his horse to the top of a mountain. He has his eagle with him on his arm, takes the hood off, and then lets the eagle fly. And so the eagle flies out to find the fox or the rabbit or whatever they're looking for, because the hunter can't necessarily see it from where he's sitting. So the eagle flies around, finds what he's looking for, swoops down, said they get going about 150 miles an hour, and then they catch the animal with its claws, and then they have a wrestling match or something, and it finally kills it. So then after that, the hunter comes down the mountain, finds his eagle, takes the prey, and then part of the eagle's what would you say, gift or whatever for killing it, is he gets part of the meat. And usually the eagle gets the lungs of the animal it just killed. And that's a tradition from many years. So he gathers up the kill, takes the eagle back in his arm, puts its hood back on, and then they go back. The Kazakhs often use music to celebrate success in hunting or celebration in their religion. They usually use a two-string guitar for their music. So most Kazakhs are Sunni Muslims, and a lot of them would believe in pre-Islam cults of the sky, ancestor, fire, and the forces of good and evil, spirits of giants and wood goblins. They wear protective beads and something else to keep them away from evil spirits. That's why I'm done.
All right. Good afternoon. So I'm missing two points of comfort that Ryan had. He had a beard and glasses, but I'll try and do without. Okay, so I felt a little like when I was studying through this Curious Cultures, I felt kind of like the man who was racing a car. Whether he ran in front of the car, he got tired, and whether he ran behind it, he got exhausted. So it was kind of that way for me. So I finally managed to stumble upon a culture that seemed rather interesting. So picture this with me. Picture you are in this culture is a country, by the way, not a group of people like Ryan had. So picture this with me, a beautiful sandy beach with azure blue water on one side, and then on the other side, picture a warm green valley with mountains in the background, sandy colored houses with clay roofs, sitting on a small incline beneath the shadow of large rocky mountains. And not Rocky Mountain. Yeah, anyway. This particular country, is full of diverse scenery. In fact, it has a wide range, even wider than what I depicted to you there. It has very unique features and culture. And what is the name of this place? Well, we'll find out. So this place has four languages, one national language, the one which we would know them to speak. This country is probably the most dangerous country for street meetings. And I'll explain why in just a second. They are known for their welcoming personality, humor, and relaxed demeanor. And this country does have a few abstract traditions that we would know and recognize. Probably one of the most well-known to us is the practice of bull running, which makes street meetings rather dangerous, as you might guess. So maybe balcony evangelism would be our ticket there. So you probably guessed it by now. It rhymes with slain and pain. Scotland, of course. So Spain is the country. This country where the Inquisition was from. The country that sent Christopher Columbus to on his historical voyage to discover the Americas. The country who had Francisco Franco as their dictator, which actually didn't mean a lot to me, but it sounded like a neat fact. He was their dictator until 1975. This is also a place where some biblical scholars would agree that possibly the biblical Tarshish where Jonah was trying to flee to, was located. Possibly. So, what is this place really like? Is Spain similar to Mexico? What is bull running? Why do they do it? Or why do they still do it today? If you are planning on traveling to Spain anytime soon, just watch out where you stand in the middle of the street. Because bull running is not just one day of the summer. Bull running actually happens all summer long at any time, particularly in the mornings. It is actually started out years ago to be a way to get the beef from the fields to the kitchen. I don't know what the hurry was, but you get the picture there. For some reason, in the middle of all of this getting this sirloin from there to here to there, I don't know. I imagine some fellow wanted to take a selfie with the bulls in kind of a running pose, and that's kind of where running with the bulls got started. I don't know. It's actually not. It has become now today what we would know as just kind of a symbol of pride or of bravery to run with the bulls. So, regardless, I wouldn't find it very relaxing to lead the bulls down the streets, but I guess some people find it quite adrenaline rushing. So, once you have learned how to avoid the bulls on the street, it's time to get a few other things straight. Do not expect to get breakfast in this corner of the earth. The Spaniards are very late scheduled. They do not typically eat much breakfast, if any. They do not get up much before 9 or 10. So for those of you who prefer late mornings, this might be your ticket. They don't have lunch until about 2 o'clock, and businesses will actually shut down for 2 to, say, 4 or 5 in the afternoon, and they will have lunch and then a 20 or 30-hour nap or siesta. Lunch is the biggest meal of the day, and they will it is the most important to them. So, after lunch at about 4 or 5 o'clock, they will go back to work then, and they will work until about 9 o'clock in the evening, where they will get off work and they will go have supper. By this time, it's probably getting rather dark, but their evening is just beginning. And they go on to do things that you would do in the evening, or maybe not you, but people over there anyways. They would start their evening very late, and they would go to the wee hours of the dawn, and then they would go back to bed. So their schedule is very, very odd, and it would take some getting used to. So, rain or shine, the Spanish people love to go outside. Oh, actually, I missed it. Rain or shine, the outdoors is mine. This would be the rule of thumb for them, because they love spending time outside. They do not particularly like being cooped up in their clay houses. And rain doesn't seem to bother them much as they do this. They are very, very talkative people, and they love talking to you. They love welcoming people, and are very, very friendly. They have, or do not have, what's called, personal space. So, as it was mentioned earlier today, somebody mentioned it, they will come right up to you, and actually even put their hand around you when they're talking to you, or on your shoulder, or whatever. And just my experience with this kind of culture, which I've only had a little bit, but for every step you take back, they take 2 steps towards you. So it's good to stay still. They're also very well known for having a great sense of humor and enjoy joking around with you. So while you're in Spain, you may as well go get a nice traditional Spanish meal in a Spanish restaurant. You will find it very, very nice and very, very relaxing, because Spain is very, very laid back. They are in no hurry whatsoever, you might say. Not like us Americans that, rush, 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 get things done, The primary comfort of the guests in the restaurant is well valued. They love to let you sit there for a long time and let you enjoy their restaurant. The problem is that while you're sitting there, you can see the waiters themselves standing around chatting while your food is on the counter, literally chilling. So they do not have any type of a sense of haste in those situations. Their diets would would very, very often, at least in the southern part of the country, be more geared towards the Mediterranean diet. So, fish, other varieties of meats, veggies, fruit, bread, cheese. Mediterranean diet, by the way, is known to be one of the healthiest in the world. So, whether that's of interest to you or not. Also, olive oil is the most important ingredient in any Spanish meal, and is included in a lot of their traditional dishes. Native olive oil that they actually get from there. So, does this laid-back culture sound good to you? Would you like a school day that ran from 9 o'clock to 5 o'clock with a 2-hour lunch break in there? Would you like a chance to take a 20 to 30-minute nap after a big lunch every day? Would you like the late culture? Would you like the outdoors mentality of the local populace? If so, maybe that's likely what you would find if you went and visited the country of Spain.
Good afternoon. Curious cultures. This is something that's interested me for a long time, and I had to wonder, what am I going to say for just 10 minutes? But I did think of that word curious just a little bit. The word curious can be mean odd. And I tell my students this, you know the story about the man who looks over at his friend and he says, you know, everybody is weird anymore except for you and me. And sometimes I wonder about you. And so I thought, you know what, maybe what I should do is talk about American culture. Just how weird is it? I have had the privilege of being an American. I am an American. However, I've also had the privilege of living the majority of my adult life now outside the country. And so it gives me a little bit of a different perspective than sometimes. What are some characteristics of American culture? I'm not going to actually talk about that because without meaning to, it seems like I offend people. And maybe that says something about American culture. Or is it me? Okay. There are a couple interesting things, though. One of them is American baseball, the great game of merit where everybody gets the equal amount of chance and so on like that. Try explaining baseball to somebody who's never played it. It's complicated. We lived in Romania for 7 years. I took my ball glove with me when we went. And 2 years later on furlough, I took it back. I never used it once. So I decided, forget that, let's play football, which is the right term for what Americans in their weirdness call soccer. Okay, American culture is known for the creation of jazz music. That's a big aspect of it. Another one is wooden stick frame residential construction. The idea of studs in your wall, that comes from the United States and has now spread over the world, and it's helped make housing affordable. So that's a nice gift that America has given. I'm not going to talk about it that much. There is one more American cultural habit that is a little bit distressing to me as a teacher, and now that I'm addressing teachers, here's my chance. Americans don't like to learn languages, not even English really well, but... They would prefer for other people to learn English. And as Christians, I would love to challenge us that we should try to reverse that in our own circles. Unfortunately, this is one of the ways that we would like to become Americans sometimes a little bit more. I would love to see foreign languages taught at our schools. And maybe beyond just a little bit of the basics. Now, all languages are going to get lost unless they're used. And so... we should be thinking about languages that could be used. So I decided that since language is the seat of culture in many ways, different cultures start with Babel, I will talk a little bit about language. But there are other neat things that we think about with culture. So, for example, clapping when you're outside of a house instead of knocking. In Botswana and other places in the southern part of Africa, when you shake hands, you reach out your one hand to shake and you clasp your wrist with your left hand. That's to let them know that there is no evil intent or whatever. That's kind of what it comes from, but it is simply cultural, and they consider it very polite that is the correct way to shake hands. There are things like that. Coughing if you want someone to leave the room, or leaving something on your plate to show you've had enough. That's already been mentioned. The offense of unshod feet in public. In an Arab country, do not put your bare feet up on anything. Many places in the world never offer your left hand to shake. That is extremely offensive. And so on like that. In Romania, one that I learned was this concept of touching your cheek. All Romanians know what that means, but few Americans do. All right? To touch your cheek means shame. That's naughty, bad, naughty. You should not do that. Okay? And so that's one that I still end up doing it sometimes when I'm trying to kind of get across to my students something. Never talk to somebody directly with your hands in your pockets. Never address a group of people with your hands in your pockets. This is sort of another cultural thing. But thinking about language, there was an interesting phrase in Romanian that I learned called bun simț. Someone has bun simț, somebody doesn't have bun simț. That translates roughly as good sense, good feeling, good way of knowing things, doing the right thing. But it's a very powerful phrase within the Romanian culture. If you tell a child that you do not have bun simț, that affects them strongly. And I've never found a phrase like that that I could use in English. I wish they would learn Romanian so I could help straighten that up. It's a very powerful cultural marker. I also tease my students because they all complain about English grammar, and I love grammar, by the way. I've just learned to rejoice in it, and English has such a simple grammar. English is not a hard language. It has a rich vocabulary. It's difficult. It has to spell and that kind of thing, but to talk and to learn, it's actually quite simple. And I would explain, for example, in Romanian, there for the words this and that, close, far away, these and those, plurals, there are 36 forms of that. Now, Donnie is an expert in Romanian, so ask him. I did have them memorize at one time, but I'm not. I'm done with that now. that's complex. There are other interesting things. Different languages use markers where they say who is talking and how many people are talking for plural verbs and singular first person and so on like that. I studied Greek, and Greek verbs are a mess. That's a real problem. Some languages don't have those inflections. English is a non-inflected language. But there are some other stuff. What's important in Indo-European language is number and tense. People want to know when what you're talking about took place and how many did it. There are languages that don't have that. Chinese has hardly any, or Mandarin, has hardly any forms of tense. You simply have to learn from context. In the Hopi language, the Aboriginal one in the Southwest, every verb came with an inflection showing how reliable the speaker considered the information, whether it was true or whether it was false or maybe, that type of thing. And also the source, where it came from. So whether he heard himself, whether he had heard it from somebody else. And they had different inflections for that. It got to be real difficult. The Ket is a language in Siberia that is dying, unfortunately. It has 11 cases. English is basically boiled down to about two, objective and nominative. That's, again, very simple. This one is 11. How do you get that many different kinds of noun? That's fascinating. And a crazy number of genders. That's a quote from the guy I'm a linguist. A crazy number of genders. And I thought, well, maybe there's hope for the students in Toronto after all. How do you make so many different genders? I don't really understand. Interestingly, what does it matter if it dies or not? We don't really care. They've discovered that Ket is related to Navajo. And so this is showing something in our background about how different peoples flowed from one place to another. So that is fascinating. And Navajo, of course, played an important role during World War II as a language that couldn't be broken. K'tu. How many of you heard of that? K'tu. I'm not saying it quite right. There we go. Tzu. That's the language of the San people in Botswana and Namibia around the Kalahari Desert. It's actually, there are several different languages. It has more consonants than any other languages, 164. 111 of them are different kinds of clicks, but they also have creeks. very rich thing. Zimbabwe, which is close to that, has 16 official languages. Japanese can be written in 4 different alphabets. And so a Japanese speaker, one of them is the Mandarin one, so a Japanese, literate Japanese person can read a Chinese newspaper but cannot speak Chinese. A whole story behind that. Dinka has no people in Africa has no regular plurals, so there's no plural marker. So just like we have child, children, those are all. They must be learned by heart. At Babel, the world broke apart into different languages, creating different and sometimes hostile cultures. In Pentecost, they came together. Learn a language. Show some interest in another culture.
Maybe not. Kind of. What continent is that?
Africa.
Africa. Thank you. She's right. It's supposed to be Africa. Okay. All right. And roughly, what country? Well, insert myself. All right, here. Roughly what? Did I say continent or country?
Kenya.
Ethiopia. Ethiopia. Got some real geography in here. It's great. All right. Well, I guess I was sort of struggling too to know what to come up with something, but I decided to defy my habit of procrastination, and I got this ready back during school time already, just because I had to write a newspaper article and something for the newspaper, so that's what I did. All right, I'd like to talk a little bit about a country in Africa, which is Ethiopia. It's located in the Great Rift Valley area of Africa. It's a tribe known there. Oh, wait, let me something else was going to. I'm going to take you on a cool tour of culture. I just thought about that the other day. Anyway, what did I come up here to write? That's why my students don't learn anything. I'm too scatterbrained. All right, the Mercy tribe, or Mercy, I guess is how you would say that, in Africa. Their population is dwindling slowly. There, I think, currently is about 7,500 Mercy people in the Great Rift Valley of Ethiopia. They're pretty much, up until about a decade ago, they were a completely oral tribe. They could not read or write. Everything was transferred orally. So that was kind of interesting. In the last several years, though, it has become almost a tourist attraction. Tourists go there and like to visit the place and see their interesting culture. And I have a few pictures. Maybe I'm revealing my childish side, but I like pictures. So I brought a few pictures along of an illustration of one of the things. All right, so their culture, they're very self-sufficient and want very little interference with the outside world. And that's why tourists coming in there can kind of pose a problem. But they're very self-sufficient. There's a joke that I'll give to you, basically because my dad was sort of bald. They say if you're bald in the front, you're a thinker. Wait, I better see if there's any bald people here first. Anyway, if you're bald in the front, you're a thinker. If you're bald in the back, you're smart. And if you're bald the whole way through, you think you're smart. Anyway, all that to say, in this African culture, they actually will shave their heads, I guess, to think they're smart. I don't know. And the women as well. All of them will shave all their hair off. That's kind of interesting. And then to replace that, they will make special kinds of headgear, something like this, to cover up their bald. I'm not sure why they don't leave the natural there. I guess it's not fancy enough. Or something like that. I don't know if you can all see that. So they have kind of some interesting head decorations. It can range from dried plants to bones to insects to wood and clay. Last but not least, cow horns. They will put for decorations as well. Another practice they have is what they call body painting. They will cover their bodies with ash and mud all over their bodies, and then they view their bodies kind of as a canvas. And unfortunately, in America, people do that too, with all the tattooing. It's almost like they're some kind of walking mural nowadays. So what they'll do is they'll take this ash and this mud, and they will create fancy designs and patterns. And a lot of time, it's to attract attention from the opposite gender. Don't get any ideas, guys. And also, it's used to protect them from the sun, from scrapes and scratches. It's kind of a protective thing as well. Sometimes they'll cover their head or their mouth with burnt or fresh cow dung. And mostly it's to deter flies and people. Perfume. I'm not going to ask how many put their perfume on this morning, but there's something interesting here about their perfume. It's very much more economical than ours. They get it right from the ground. It's a mixture of dead plants and other secretive ingredients, which I'm not sure what all that is. It gives them a very unique smell. I don't think ours does this, but they also use it to ward off parasites. I don't know that our perfume does that, but anyway, theirs does. So I guess it's practical. They can keep parasites by putting on their perfume. All right, one of the interesting things that led me to this culture was, and you probably saw that already. I left that on the bench. Oh, well, that's fine. Their lip discs. This was something interesting to me. I just learned this. Do you want to bring that up here, Derek? I just learned this recently. There's a culture that does this. It used to be more of a common culture. My tape, actually, that would be. I didn't specify that. It used to be more of a common culture in a lot of African countries, but the women wear these lip discs, and that's what I spent a little bit of time talking about. It's really kind of weird. There's a lot of different varieties of these, so let me keep talking here. It's usually formed of clay or wood, and each woman kind of designs their own lip disc as sort of a statement for their... We'll talk about it a little more. First, what they'll do is, when they're about 12 or 13, they will... can you all see them, kind of? What they'll do is they'll actually take out about 2 to 4 of their front teeth. They'll take those out. And then they'll make an incision right here on their lip, about an inch to inch and a half long. That's kind of gruesome. Sorry, ladies. I'll talk over this way. They'll make it in their lip. And then they take this little wooden peg and they insert it in their lip. And they let it there for about several months until that cutout is healed up. And then they slowly keep working different sizes of pegs and discs. There's probably not room, but into that incision, they keep working different sizes and keep stretching that thing bigger and bigger. And some of them, most of them are from 3 to 5. The largest ever recorded was a 7-inch lip disc. So when it comes to the size of the plate, it's not a one-size-fits-all ratio. It's definitely... some women actually will put it in their lower and their upper lip, which really looks interesting. I should have got a picture of it, but they look like big quackers, like a duck. but it's really, really fascinating. Anyway, why do they do this? Well, some of it's a symbol of social adulthood. We've reached adulthood. It's a sign of moving from adolescence to womanhood. It's also believed to improve and intensify a woman's beauty as well as increase her status and wealth. In more recent times, like I said, it's a way for them to earn money. They will actually pose for pictures, and then people will pay them to pose for a picture. So it's becoming a way to earn money. It's false to think that these lip plates are worn all the time. They wear them for guest receptions when they have company over. They wear them. They wear them for when they serve food to their husbands. They put their lip disc in. Anytime they're around men, they pretty much wear them for holidays, etc. Although other times of the day they take them out, so basically they're left with this big hole in their lip all the time. Another thing they practice is sacrification. When boys and girls approach their full height, they will actually take and slice their skin with a razor, and they'll take a special tool and lift it up and make a little bit of a... and then that heals and lets a welt. And they'll do it all over their arms and bodies. They'll put these welts. It's called a kachoga, I believe is how it's said. It's usually done after killing an enemy or some kind of big success that shows bravery. They will do that. And so, really, if you're walking around with a whole string of welts down your arm, you're a pretty brave guy. So I thought that was kind of interesting. It's a mark of pride and things like that. Anyway, I will stop. Actually, I'll just let them up here if you want to look at them closer.